You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Indeed Sponsored Jobs. Are you on the lookout for a star signing to add to your team? Well, Indeed Sponsored Jobs will help you to narrow down your search, attracting the best qualified people for the role by focusing on the candidates who have the right skills and experience for you. Indeed Sponsored Jobs will make your job ad stand out from the crowd, and it will help you sort through the applicants to draw up your shortlist more easily. Join more than 1.6 million companies that use Indeed Sponsored Jobs. If you're hiring, Indeed is all you need. You'll spend more time interviewing the candidates who check all of your boxes. There's less stress, less time spent, and better results with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners to the Cycling Podcast will get a £100 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves. Go to indeed.com/cycle. That's indeed.com/cycle. Go there right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on the Cycling Podcast. Indeed.com/cycle. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed. Terms and conditions apply. Now it's on with the show.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello, welcoming you for the first cycling podcast of the month of February after a weekend when the reigning world TT champion won three times. The world cyclocross champion claimed that title for a record eighth time, and the world road race champion premiered a hairstyle from 8 Mile. My name is Daniel Freeman. I'm the host of this episode in which we will dissect all of the aforementioned action from the last few days in professional cycling, the cross, the coiffures, and more besides. Joining me to do that today are the real Slim Shady of Not Watford, Lionel Burney.
Hello, Daniel.
And our other guest has already got his head in his hands, and that guest is the MC with the sickest flow in professional cycling. His name is Rob Hatch. Did you get the M&M reference there? You don't listen to that kind of thing,
really,
do you?
No, sorry.
Well, I was going to say, Daniel,
it's Lancashire's Rob Hatch.
Would the real Slim Shady of cycling, Tadej Pogacar, with his new M&M hairstyle, would he win an 8 Mile time trial?
Yeah, it depends on the terrain.
It depends who else is racing, I guess, as well.
Yeah.
Hey, I got that one, by the way. Can I have a prize?
Who would you like to see? A battle rap between Tadej Pogacar and Mathieu van der Poel. Who would win that?
Pog. He's a more natural speaker.
Do you think Pog? Of course. I think a lot of people have forgotten that 2020, when he sort of... he appeared on the scene in 2019, of course, won three stages at the Vuelta. But in 2020, when he was on his way to winning the Tour de France, in our sort of mad initial scramble for some sort of colour, some sort of background story about Pogacar, we didn't really know that much about him then. One thing that surfaced at that point that we all grasped and put on social media, posted on social media, was, remember the Pog rap? Oh. Remember that little clip of him rapping sort of in front of his Amstrad computer? You remember that?
This is desperate stuff, this really, isn't it? I mean, trying to appear down with the kids with 25-year-old references here. And of course, in Europe, the film 8 Mile is called 12.8 kilometres. Let's move on to something that's really popular with the kids, cyclocross.
Yeah, apparently it is. Was it 44,000 people at the World Championships of the
Huge
weekend?
Huge crowds, yeah.
To see Mathieu van der Poel win an eighth title, therefore surpass the late Eric de Vlaeminck and to become the sole holder of that record. And that's about all I've got to say about it, chaps.
Well, I'll say a bit more then, Daniel, because it does equal the record on the women's side. Marianne Vos has won the cyclocross title 8 times as well. Rob, you've come from one extreme to the other. You've been in Australia, the heat of an Aussie summer, the Ashes cricket and the Tour Down Under, 43 degrees, I think was the mercury hit, didn't it? And now you've got a stint commentating on the Winter Olympics, going to be doing a few of those events. And, well, there was a sort of wintry feel of quite a muddy course at the cyclocross at the weekend, And Matthew van der Poel, yeah, 8 World Cyclocross Championship wins in his career, a new record. And there's been some hints, haven't there, that he will hang up his cyclocross bike. Do you hang up your bike? I guess you do. And that he might scale back the cyclocross perhaps now that he has taken that record. I mean, it will take at least a decade for anyone to get close to that. I suspect it may be one of those records that doesn't get beaten. And he was very, very impressive. You know, I've watched a lot of the cyclocross this winter, and every race I've watched, it seems that he has won. And there's a very good reason for that, because his record in the cyclocross since he turned elite in 2013-14 is just unbelievable. He's won 75% of the cyclocross races that he started, 183 of 244 starts. He hadn't lost for a couple of seasons. His last defeat, if you can put it that way, was a fifth place in the Benidorm World Cup round a couple of years ago, and he's won every race of the winter. And he kind of does it in a similar way. He races with such kind of confidence and patience. He doesn't kind of necessarily go all out right from the start, but he chooses his moment to make his move and just gradually stretches away and puts everybody else on the back foot. And it's, you know, there's no response, and before you know it, it's too late. And I mean, in the World Championship race on Sunday, he was stretching clear right from the sort of the, you know, the opening forays. You know, he sort of didn't get the fastest of start off the grid, did he, Rob? But he moved up through the bodies that were in front of him and was away at the front. And he had Tibor Del Grosso, his teammate, both another Dutchman and an Alpecin Premier Tech rider, just there riding as sort of insulation blanket almost. And as Van der Poel stretched away, Tibor Del Grosso kind of eased off and took Thibaut Nys backwards with him. And by the second lap, Van der Poel was away solo. And that was that. I mean, a formality. And then Del Grosso managed to crack Nace on the last lap, because the Belgian kind of faltered on a steep, muddy uphill bit. The rain was falling by that point. And really, really impressive by Van der Poel, the greatest cyclocross rider of all time. And Rob, I don't know what you think, but there's been this chat about whether or not cyclocross should be included in the Winter Olympics in future years. Quite a bit of lobbying going on. I know the Winter Olympics generally, the move is to try and ensure that it doesn't become endangered by climate change and obsolete. They're also concerned about the imbalance of events between summer and winter Olympics. There's an awful lot of pressure on the summer Olympics, isn't there? And it does make me wonder whether some of the indoor sports might be best suited moving across to the Winter Olympics. You could see track cycling as part of the Winter Olympics, table tennis, judo, could even include darts. And I think cyclocross would be a genuine welcome addition to the Winter Olympic program. At the moment, of course, there's the Olympic Charter, isn't there, that said every sport has to take place on snow or ice in some form, I think. And of course, you know, you can't necessarily guarantee that with cyclocross. But what do you reckon? Cyclocross in the Winter Olympics next time round?
Cyclocross, a winter sport, should definitely be in the Winter Olympics. It's something that struck me as soon as I went to my first cyclocross event. I mean, I'm sure a few of you remember, I was very lucky to do a full season commentating on site a few years ago, just before the pandemic. Absolutely loved it. I hadn't really experienced it before. But what an atmosphere. I know it's difficult to sell it outside of Belgium and of the Netherlands, and that's sort of an ongoing issue, isn't it, that we have in the sport to try and globalise it. And maybe you need new strategies there. One of the strategies could be have it in the Winter Olympics. It could be beneficial for the Winter Olympics, beneficial for the sport. Track cycling, I'm with you on that as well, because I think that track cycling as a summer sport does not work. Certainly, if you want the best athletes to be involved, if you want that crossover between road and track, I've long said that, and long people have looked at me a bit funny and said, oh, what are you on about? But I think if you want the sport to grow, it has to be a winter sport. It does not work otherwise. And just on Mathieu van der Poel, I mean, he's incredible, isn't he? Very quickly this year, you just talked about what he did at the World Championships. This year also won the World Cup, despite not competing in all of the events. And in the World Cup, when he starts from about the third or the fourth row back. So he has to make his way through traffic of about 15, 20, maybe 25 riders in the first couple of laps, and then beat everybody. So everybody else has got a head start on him. He's got the skill to do that. He's got the power from the road to do that. He's just an exceptional, exceptional bike rider. And I understand why people maybe switch it on every weekend, waiting for him to be beaten to see somebody different win, because that's, you know, it's like watching Pogacar and Vingegaard at the minute on the road, isn't it? You know, will somebody else win? I think with Van der Poel, you just have to take your hat off and say, wow, what an athlete.
If only people could see Daniel's body language while we're talking about cyclocross, Rob.
I mean, that's partly to do with the Winter Olympics. I mean, we've got the Winter Olympics starting in the next few hours in Milan Cortina.
It's already underway, Daniel. Curling's already on.
Well, okay. As occurs with every Olympics now, we're already on the front page of L'Equipe. This morning, there's a lot of hand-wringing about the 2030 Winter Olympics in the Alps. But there has been all sorts of controversy, all sorts of, probably we're going to find out, corruption to do with the Winter Olympics. And I would just sort of counsel caution to any sport that wants to make its bed with the IOC, because that organisation and the Olympics themselves have a pretty sort of unsavoury recent record of things that sports don't necessarily want to be associated with. However, on Mathieu van der Poel and on...
As a cycling aficionados, Daniel, we should love this. We should embrace it. The ice hockey arena's not ready. There's been a doping scandal already with one of the Italian athletes. You're right about the sort of the corruption element of, you know, where's the money gone and how is it all...
And particularly with Milan Cortina, the environmental impact is absolutely egregious. Just on Mathieu van der Poel, one thing I would like to point out, a friend of the podcast, Falk Nier, who he used to be a German Davis Cup player, actually, but then he became a manager of cyclists. He collaborates with Alpecin, and I know he's been involved in, it was a very interesting little documentary film that I did watch about Mathieu van der Poel, Tibor Del Grosso, and their involvement in cyclocross, the Rudhoff brothers, the sort of genesis of that Alpecin team. It's not the most catchily named film, Two Brothers, One Team, Clear Vision, but it is excellent. I think it's about 20 minutes. I would recommend that. Look it up. It's on YouTube.
I think you're right, though, Rob. You know, the one thing that could really... spread cyclocross's popularity would be inclusion in the Olympics, and also the UCI are tweaking the rules, aren't they, so that points won in other disciplines will count towards a sort of super points total when it comes to the UCI points. So there will be incentives for other riders and other teams to maybe spread their wings a bit, and there might be opportunities for riders who excel at other disciplines to have a higher profile in the sport, and it might finally break out of this sort of the Belgian-Dutch bubble. Should just mention also Lucinda Brand, who has similarly dominated the women's cyclocross all winter. She won the world title for the first time since 2021, her second rainbow jersey in a cyclocross. Although she's been on the podium every year since then. A little bit of doubt going into it about her fitness, because she suffered a calf injury a couple of weeks prior to the Worlds, but rode really well. And by lap three, she was out in the lead. I mean, the Dutch dominated, because Alvarado took the silver medal and Puk Pieterse took the bronze, despite a pretty hard crash on one of the descents. That was a really good race as well. Daniel, I recommend the Cyclocross World Championships to you next year.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast Team Car, the back of the pack, please.
This episode of the Cycling Podcast is brought to you by BICMO Cycle Insurance, because let's face it, things happen. Whether it's a crash landing, the heartbreak of a stolen bike, or the ultimate facepalm moment of reversing over your prized aero wheel, BICMO has you covered. Flexible policies that you can cancel anytime, 50% off extra bikes in your household, protection for your kit, race entries, and even damage while travelling to your next epic ride. They've thought of it all. And here's the thing, BICMO isn't some faceless insurance company. They're all bike riders too, with a shared mission to protect the world's riders and the places we ride. So when you insure with them, you're not just getting great coverage, you're joining a community that gets what it means to love cycling. So whether you're smashing sprints, grinding climbs, or just enjoying a Sunday spin, ride safe. BICMO's got your back. Protect your ride before it's too late. Head to BICMO.com to get covered. That's BICMO.com. Flexible policies. Cancel any time. Terms apply. Check your policy docs.
Well, chaps, that's the cyclocross dealt with. Winter Olympics as well. One thing I should point out, I might be getting this slightly wrong, but I have seen quotes from Mathieu van der Poel suggesting that he doesn't think the cyclocross should be involved, should be included in the Winter Olympics, because he doesn't think that riding on snow is really representative of the rest of the sport. Don't know if that's true or not.
That's certainly true. It would require the Winter Olympics to alter its definition of what a Winter Olympic sport is slightly. But I think that is coming, isn't it? For various reasons. They want to make the Winter Olympics an event that even Daniel Freiber can enjoy.
There'll be mud skiing before you know it. The way things are going, that's what will end up happening. Anyway, chaps, we're going to talk about road racing, if you remember what that is, later in the episode. But first of all, we're going to focus a bit more on one of the big news stories of the last few weeks, and that was the announcement, which always sort of comes out of nowhere now. There's no sort of set date when ASO announced who is going to get the nod as far as wild cards are concerned for the Tour de France. Now, once upon a time, this was always a very important event in the cycling calendar, and it was very hotly contested. It was often very, very controversial, particularly in the early sort of 2000s. But the World Tour, the advent of the World Tour and its sort of precursors have, they've brought a bit of clarity, haven't they? There are sort of set criteria now. Okay, there is still scope for ASO, and they do still make a sort of more subjective choice. But such as a concentration of kind of wealth and stability in the World Tour, that there aren't that many contenders for the remaining wildcard places nowadays. And that was particularly the case this year, so we thought. And, well, the announcement was that the remaining two were effectively up for grabs, and wildcard places were going to go to Total Energy. That wasn't a surprise at all. And the last place was going to go to the Spanish team, Caja Rural. That was a surprise. And I don't know whether we had been a little bit hasty, a little bit premature, most of us, in assuming that the last wild card would go to another team. And that was Unibet. Rose, I'm going to give it its English pronunciation, Rockets, formerly the Tietema. What was its last name under the sort of Tietema appellation?
The Unibet Tietema Rockets.
That was last year. Yes. Now, of course, this is a Dutch team in terms of DNA, but a French registered team, which has been growing over the last few years. Obviously, they've made a big splash on social media. That is part of their sort of USP, that they are run by younger individuals. They have a slightly more sort of unusual, innovative, idiosyncratic model, I suppose. And they've made some high-profile signings. They've made a big splash in the transfer market over the last few months. They signed Dylan Groenewegen, and they also signed Walt Poels. They've signed some other significant riders, Victor Lafay, who hasn't raced yet so far this season. And they are also registered in France. I mentioned their Dutch DNA. Well, why do they register in France? This happened last year. A couple of reasons. One, we thought, was to improve their chances of one day getting a wild card for the Tour de France. And the other reason was to sort of circumvent very stringent laws in the Netherlands over gambling sponsorship in sports. So we sort of assumed that they were in the box seat to get this wild card. And I don't know what they thought, but certainly judging by the announce or the sort of their reaction on social media, it was certainly something that was on their radar that they were going to get the last wild card. And they didn't. They didn't. What was your initial reaction, chaps? Because we'll dive into the merits of the two teams, the sporting merits of the two teams in a minute. But what was your initial reaction?
Initial reaction was one of surprise, mainly because of the registration. I thought they'd gone very cleverly about their business. They'd sort of tried to make this bet over the last 18 months of where they were going to lie, and the ASO were going to see that and, you know, be very happy with that. They did have an opportunity. You talk about the sporting criteria. They finished inside the top 30 teams last year, which you have to do now, which is a brand new rule to be invited into a Grand Tour. And they made the big signings, didn't they? Certainly with Dylan Groeneveld, a six-time Tour de France stage winner, man who's won on the Champs-Élysées before. You thought that they had ticked all the boxes when opposed to Caja Rural, who are an historic team, an historic sponsor, been to a lot of Grand Tours, but don't really have that star name.
Yeah, just before we hear from you, Lionel, just on that sporting, those sporting results, Rob, you mentioned that they finished inside the top 30 last year. In 2025, in fact, Unibet were 26th in the rankings. That's the single year rankings. And Caja Rural were 25th. So pretty narrow margin between them, but Caja Rural superior last year. And in the three-year cycle, 2023 to 2025, then Caja Rural were significantly ahead of Unibet. But that we would expect that because Unibet is a team who's, I think their spending power, but also their results have increased, improved every year.
I don't think they've actually been a pro tour team for the whole of that three-year cycle either. So the capacity to go into those big races and get those points, I don't think that's a fair comparison. But obviously last year certainly was. And as you say, Caja Rural did perform better, which surprised me when I looked at it.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is that it was a straight shootout, really only one place was truly up for grabs, wasn't it? Because Cofidis, Pinarello, Q36.5, Tudor Pro Cycling were all more or less guaranteed a place in the Tour de France, and by various different criteria, by dint of either being at the top of the second tier or courtesy of their performance last season. Total Energies, which is a team that does give the impression of being on its last legs somewhat. There was the rumours of the potential merger with Ineos Grenadiers. The Total Energies company logo appears on the Ineos Grenadiers jersey as well. But that merger didn't come to fruition. But the team itself is, well, I mean, it's, can I put it this way? It's a sort of super unleaded petrol version of the sort of the diesel that it was back in the Peter Sagan days. So it left this one place. And I mean, on the face of it, you would think, well, Caja Rural is a surprise. But when you look at the other factors, such as the fact that the Tour de France starts in Barcelona, that's probably one factor. Caja Rural has got a very long association with cycling as a company. It sponsored a cycling team in the late 1980s. It's a cooperative bank that specialises in, most of its clients work in the agricultural industries in Spain. I think that's right, isn't it, Rob? And that Caja Rural team in the 80s, whilst not linked to this one in any way, other than through the title sponsor being the same, was quite a big team at the time, wasn't it? Marino Lajareta was a star rider. His kind of USP was that he would ride all three Grand Tours in the same year. He did that at least once for them. And that's back in the days when the Vuelta, of course, was in April. So he'd do the Vuelta and the Giro back to back and then do the Tour de France. And he was a real kind of reliable GC rider. But Caja Rural pulled out of cycling suddenly in mid-1989 because there was a bit of a financial crisis in the Spanish banking industry. And so Caja Rural stopped sponsorship and a company called Paternina took over for the 1989 Tour de France. So it's for someone of my generation, Caja Rural, the dark green jersey with the yellow logo, you know, it's synonymous with the Tour de France. And of course, as a current team, it's been around a long time, really starting from very grassroots level about 25 years ago as a kind of club team and then moving up, expanding. Way back in the day, 2010 this is, when it was at it was ranked as a UCI team, it gave Michał Kwiatkowski his first break in cycling as a 20-year-old. He rode a season for them. And they've had some big-name riders over the years, people that you'll instantly know: Jose Herrada, David de la Cruz, Omar Fraile, Peo Bilbao, Hugh Carthy, of course, Alex Aramburu, Oye Lazcano, maybe say a little less about him at the moment, and in recent years, Matteo Malucelli, and their current stars are Adel Balderstone and Yuri Letao. So their credentials really are longevity, the fact they're Spanish, they've ridden the Vuelta every year since 2012, except 2022 and 2024. Sporting merit, I mean, only one Vuelta stage win in that all of that time, and that was way back in the first year, 2012, Antonio Piedra won a stage. But they've kind of been part of the fabric of the Vuelta, and a team that riders have learned their trade and gone on to bigger things with World Tour teams. So I can see the sort of sporting merits, but I think, you know, the political merit maybe, and perhaps this is a bit speculative, but a little bit of a wait your turn to the Unibet Rose Rockets from ASO, rather than ushering them in pretty much the first attempt.
There was a certain sniffiness in Christian Prudhomme's yes. comments about the Unibet team. He was very dismissive of this French identity, or certainly their French registration. He pointed to the fact that they have a majority of Dutch riders. Well, they certainly have more Dutch riders than French riders. It's actually quite an international team. It's becoming more and more international. And, I mean, I don't know about you chaps, but looking at the respective rosters, if I had to choose which of the teams was more likely to have a big impact at the Tour de France, I would have said Unibet Rose Rockets, particularly based on the sort of start of the season that Dylan Groenewegen's had. And then you also consider, well, what I said about the way the team has marketed itself, a very effective and innovative way of marketing itself, and then also the involvement of people like Marcel Kittel's come on board as the sprint coach. And Caja Rural is not a team, even at the Vuelta, that has a particularly flamboyant, they're not known for doing anything out of the ordinary. They're not sort of a modern day Kelme type team. That's probably an unfortunate comparison, in the sense that you sort of notice them any more than you notice Burgos Biache or any of the other sort of teams that are on the carousel that go into the Vuelta. Just on that, incidentally, on the Spanish Pro Conti teams, and as I said, they have a sort of, the Vuelta now has a bit of a carousel system whereby one of those teams has sort of missed out every year. And when people heard Caja Rural, they might have had a vague memory of a bit of a scandal, or the whiff of something untoward about this team from a couple of years ago. There was a story that broke mid-Vuelta in 2023 about this team's alleged involvement with Spanish doping operation, Operación Ilex. And this was about documents that had supposedly been circulated around other Spanish teams and the cycling world in general, and also journalists. I think it was 23 pages of leaked documents from this doping case, Operación Ilex, which centered on, among other things, there's a doctor in Extremadura, Marcos Maynard. And it sort of postulated links between, among other people, teams, organizations, Caja Rural and Maynard. That was pretty much discredited, but recently, in fact, only a few days ago, it was deemed that, well, the leak had been traced back to the manager of another Spanish Pro Conti team, Euskaltel Euskadi, and there had been some CCTV footage, in fact, from a post office in Vitoria in the Basque Country of the Euskaltel Euskadi manager, Jesus Escurdia, taking envelopes and basically posting these documents, these 23 documents from Operación Ilex, to various people in Spanish cycling. And this was all part, supposedly, of the sort of war for Vuelta wildcards, Euskaltel versus Caja Rural versus Burgos Biache. Anyway, it did seem at one point as though Escurdia would be charged with this act. I can't remember exactly what the charge would have been, but it was deemed just a few days ago by a judge that there wasn't sufficient evidence to charge him. So that case is now closed. But Caja Rural have also been pretty much, well, they've been sort of cleared of any wrongdoing in this Spanish doping investigation. That was just to sort of clear that up, if as I said, sort of vague bells were ringing when people heard Caja Rural and they were wondering, well, is that not a team with a dirty reputation?
Wonderful stuff, Daniel, and yet you have the temerity to criticise the Winter Olympics for being a bit of a murky circus. Dear me.
Now, Kaharu Rao, by the way, have sort of slowly been developing their relationship with ASO. Because from my mind, they've been in Paris-Nice in the last couple of years. They've been to a couple of other stage races where I've sort of raised my eyebrow and gone, oh, it's a bit of a left-field inclusion when there are other French teams to go for. And you mentioned the Vuelta, Daniel. They've actually made the Vuelta's organisers' jobs a little easier this year, haven't they, by going to the Tour de France. They've said, well, you don't come to the Vuelta then because the Vuelta wildcards are announced on the same day. There's no opportunity this year to pick Euskaltel because they finished 34th out of the 30 teams. So they are way, way down. And I think as well that Unibet Tietema Rockets being left out of the Tour might well make the Giro's organisers' job a little easier as well, because this would be very RCS, wouldn't it, to want somebody with all the publicity and the YouTube and all that sort of stuff that Unibet Tietema Rockets would like. They haven't yet announced their Giro wildcards. Cofidis have turned down their opportunity, so they've got an extra card to play. You'd imagine they'll want to invite Vuefe Gruppo, Bardiani, as they're called again now. They'll want to invite Polti, to Italian teams. Now, according to last year's rankings, they can't invite what was Solution Tech because they finished in 31st. But will there be a little of a rejigging of that league table saying, well, a couple of these teams don't exist anymore. Shall we bump them up into the top 30? That would be also very UCI, wouldn't it, in sort of negotiating things. So that, I guess, remains an outside possibility. But the one team in the top 30 that I'm looking at that wouldn't have ridden a grand tour would be Unibet Tietema Rockets. So maybe they can sneak into the Giro d'Italia.
Yeah, they've already had invites. They've had invites for the big one-day races, haven't they? Strade Bianche and Milan-San Remo as well. Just a couple more things on Caja Rural. We get this unusual, sort of intriguing city rivalry as well now at the Tour de France. I was trying to think, when was the last time two teams not from France but from the same city, and in this case I'm talking about Pamplona in Spain, so we've got Movistar and Caja Rural, both from Pamplona, were in Tour de France. That's pretty unusual, I would suggest. Just another thing about Caja Rural, and that you mentioned that 1980s team, Lionel, 1987, 1988, they rode the Tour de France, Caja Rural Orbea. And one of the riders in 1997, I believe, was Pascal Jules, who was a good friend of, he was sort of Laurent Fignon's best friend, and he died tragically later that year after riding the Tour de France. He fell asleep at the wheel of his car and had a tragic accident. One of his sons was called Justin, Justin's mother, so Pascal's widow, later remarried to a man who, by all accounts, mistreated, indeed abused her, so much so that one day Justin couldn't tolerate it anymore and attacked the stepfather. The stepfather died in the altercation, Justin having struck him with a crowbar. Justin was later sentenced to 3 years in prison for manslaughter, a judge having ruled that he was acting in self-defense. And then Justin Jules later became a professional cyclist, and he won the GP La Marseillaise in, was it 2011 or 2013? Anyway, he retired in 2021, so he's no longer a professional rider. His last team was Delco.
But what about Unibet Rose Rockets then? Because they've been on this trajectory towards the Tour de France. They've made it absolutely clear that that's where they want to get to. The Dylan Groenewegen signing was quite a coup, and they pulled it off very well. The social media around that, I remember talking about that at the time last year. They've also got Rory Townsend, of course, who won a World Tour race, the World Tour race in Hamburg last summer, the one that's normally a sprint, but he held on to win in really dramatic circumstances. The great irony for me here is that part of the reason for the team being registered in France is because of the changing and tightening laws on betting sponsorship in sport in the Netherlands. And when you go back 20 years, there was a team sponsored by the Unibet company, which is a bookmaker, an online betting company. They took over a Belgian team called Mr. Bookmaker, and they became Unibet. And I think at one point they had Rigoberto Urán on the roster, 2006-07, something like that.
Frank Vandenbroek
as well. Yeah. And they were more or less barred from racing in France. They were a Pro Tour team in 2007, which was the equivalent of the World Tour today. They should have been given a guaranteed slot in the 2007 Tour de France, but they weren't. It was withheld. They had raced in France, but instead of having the Unibet sponsorship on their jersey, they raced in a jersey with a big question mark on. And there was
also
this whole...
green and white, a la Carreron.
Yeah, there was this sort of whole question mark about the direction that sports betting was going, and resistance in France to any sports betting logos appearing in televised sport. And so that was the reason that the Unibet team didn't ride the 2007 Tour de France. And I mean, basically, pretty much ended the team. They reverted to a Belgian identity the next year, became Kolstrop for a year, I think, and then that was that done. The irony is that the rules in France have kind of relaxed a bit over the last 20 years, but there are talks to tighten them back up again and once again ban betting sponsorship from appearing in sports as they're going on. And that would mean logos on football shirts. It would mean advertising banners in football grounds. And then you would have to think it would also mean a cycling team racing around in a jersey sponsored by a betting company, because there's a real debate about whether this is entirely healthy for televised sport to be quite so firmly linked with betting companies. And so there's going to be some issues coming down the line. I mean, the genius of the team, though, is that they could, they've given themselves the Rockets moniker. So they've got a better way around any potential sponsorship restrictions. And the team's identity is kind of greater than the name of its team sponsor, which is one of the great limiting factors of professional cycling's entire business model, isn't it? You're sponsored by your company, and then you're sponsored by another company. And
we've seen various teams try to circumvent that. I would say with limited success, try to establish an identity that sits aside from the main sponsor. Only in the last week, we had an announcement from EF Education First that their naming rights are up for grabs. There's a first name on the jersey, although the team will continue to be, what I understood, the team will continue to be owned by EF. They're offering sort of prime position on their jersey, but that's a team that from very early on in its existence, they tried to establish an identity that sat, as I say, aside from whatever kind of corporate identity wanted to attach itself to that team. And it's sort of fallen by the wayside, hasn't it? The slipstream, Argyle, whether it's the visual identity, the name, they are no longer really prominent.
Just before we move on and talk about the racing in the last part, those Tour de France places being confirmed means that Pinarello Q36.5 gets a first start of the Tour de France. That means, in all likelihood, Tom Pidcock will be back at the Tour de France after his impressive Vuelta for Q36.5 last summer. And Tudor Pro Cycling, I mean, no doubt about the merits of their selection after last year's performance and their ranking, but also obviously having Julian Alaphilippe. So what will be interesting will be to see Pidcock's performance at the Tour de France. And that adds another sort of dimension to the race, I think.
Chaps, just before we do move on and talk solely about racing, since we were talking about betting, I just wondered what your thoughts were about Tadej Pogacar unveiling his new endorsement deal with a cryptocurrency exchange platform, KuCoin. Did you see this in the last few days?
I sort of saw the headline. I saw what it was about and I was like, oh no, here we go. And I sort of turned away. I didn't really want to know about it, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's as most cryptocurrency exchanges and people involved in that world, they're not exactly renowned for their pristine reputations. No. But this company is no exception. I would just welcome readers. I'm not going to go into the weeds of this company and its history now, but needless to say, there are a fair number of legitimate question marks about this deal, and I would welcome, or I would invite the listeners to look up Inner Ring's contribution to this excellent cycling blog. Inner Ring has some interesting information about KuCoin and the people behind KuCoin, the recent history of that company. And in fact, I'm getting a call from Tadej Pogacar's agent right now because I phoned him for clarification early on. We'll update you on what happens in that call later next week, in fact.
Just on that, Daniel, without going into the sort of the history of NFTs and all of this, you know, and being a skeptical type, my usual reaction to these things is a sort of sense of weariness of the latest grift coming along. I mean, sometimes proven right, sometimes proven wrong on these things. But I do also think, you know, the relationship between the sport and its sponsors in terms of teams and individuals, sometimes I do wish that there was some sort of, a bit of a stiffer backbone when it comes to some of these things. I mean, Pogacar's riding for a team, UAE Team Emirates, which, you know, I'm not going to raise this every single time we talk about UAE Team Emirates, but the issue of the UAE's alleged involvement in the war in Sudan is important and significant. And especially this week, Pep Guardiola, the manager of Manchester City, a football club owned by Abu Dhabi, he spoken out on behalf of children in Palestine, Ukraine, and various other places, you know, war-torn, ravaged places. He mentioned Sudan, and I wonder how that's going to go down with his ultimate paymasters.
I did wonder where those morals had been for the last 10 years.
Quite, but I think it's dangerous to say, oh, well, he hasn't said anything for 10 years, so therefore what he says now is invalid. I don't think that's the case. I think it's a case of eyes opening, waking up, and actually, rather than just going, oh, shrugging and saying, oh, this is just too difficult to deal with, we've seen where that led with the Israel Premier Tech team, and I'm not going to open that one up again now because we need to move on and talk about the racing. But I think that the sport, it's kind of lack of any sort of backbone and leadership from the very top, and I'm talking about the UCI here, means that it is ripe to be picked off and just kind of used as a vehicle for whatever. And I think that really it has a greater responsibility than that.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car, the back of the pack, please.
This episode is also sponsored by Babbel, the app that can help you to learn a new language so that one day you could be fluent in multiple languages like Daniel and Rob here, who between them speak French, Italian, Spanish. Daniel speaks German as well, and occasionally they dabble in a bit of English. Learning a language with Babbel is all about making small steps regularly. It's a bit like training for a major cycling event. The more regular and consistent your practice, the better, stronger, and more confident you become. And eventually, the wins become big wins. And you can track your progress all the way through with the Babbel app. Babbel will help you to learn in the way that you learn best. So whether that's by listening or speaking, reading or writing, Babbel can adapt to your style and keep you motivated with personalized learning plans, real-time feedback, and progress tracking. Of course, you don't want to fall foul of the pronunciation police. And when you get out there and start using your new language with the local people, whether you're off to the Giro d'Italia, Tour de France, or Vuelta a España, you want to know your pronunciation and not fall foul of the pronunciation police. Hey, Rob, there's a special limited time deal for all of the Cycling Podcast listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription at babbel.com/cycle. That's a 60% discount at babbel.com/cycle. And it's spelled babbel.com/cycle. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Well, chaps, bit of an update, bit of a not quite a stop press on the Pogacar crypto exchange. No news for the moment, but there could be some news later today or in the next couple of days on that. That's all I'm allowed to say, but we'll have a full update next week. Time to get to some racing, and we are going to head, well, Rob, you're already in Mallorca, but we are going to travel back in time and travel to Mallorca because it was, of course, the Challenge Mallorca last week. I can't remember whether Remco had already, yes, he had already won the team time trial with his Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe teammates when we recorded last week. But then over the weekend, he went on to win the next two installments of the Challenge Mallorca, giving himself a perfect record in those races. First three starts, in fact, for his new team, Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. Three wins. This, incidentally, chaps, coincided with his old boss, Patrick Lefebvre, going on a podcast in Belgium, La Danielle Earls podcast, and telling them he hates Frank Denk. And Frank Denk, Ralph Denk, who of course is Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe's team manager and Remco's new boss. Of course, their beef dates back two or three years, doesn't it? It was the sort of first approach that Denk made to, at the time, Lefebvre was the team manager, Quickstep team manager. And Denk already back then was trying to get Remco out of his contract. This was very fractious. It became very fractious. And Lefebvre has not forgotten that. Incidentally, Patrick Lefebvre is doing better. We know he's had some health problems recently, but he is back home and convalescing, shall we say. But anyway, chaps, Remco, a dominant performance. It didn't really surprise anyone, I don't suppose, particularly given the courses. Those last 2 days in Mallorca, they lent themselves to Remco attacks, Remco solos, and that's what we got. We got a very big one on the first of those 2 days on the weekend. It was about 50 kilometres, wasn't it? And then, sorry, Rob, go on.
No, about 55k's from the finish, right up Coy de Soya, yeah, which you've ridden up before, and very close to the top. I think he didn't manage to drop everybody there. He had two riders with him. Surprisingly, and I suppose this is really good news for Remco fans, it means he's been doing some work and the confidence is there, on that very technical descent on the other side of Coy de Soya, where he actually dropped the other two riders.
And it was a similar story the next day, wasn't it? He dispatched. It was Mathis Rondel on Sunday. So what a start. What a remarkable start. But as I said, I'm not particularly surprised. Remco is someone who has always started the season pretty well. I mean, he's a rider who comes in hot at any and every point of the season when he's had a big break. And we see that more and more. Riders don't tend to take sort of a month of racing now to find their groove. They are competitive immediately, and that's certainly been the case with Remco. Of course, he's on the same bike, or maybe a slightly updated bike from last year, so no great changes on that front, and it's looking pretty good for him. That said, of course, last week I did tell everyone to ignore everything really until about the end of March. I'm going to completely contradict myself now and say that while watching those last 2 days in Mallorca, I was sort of casting my thoughts ahead to Milan-San Remo in a few weeks. And of course, he's debuting there, isn't he? He's never done it before. And I was just sort of thinking about his flat speed, thinking about how comfortable Filippo Ganna, or how well Ganna's done on the Poggio, for example, particularly last year, and thinking that Remco could be a big threat at Milan-San Remo. Rob, you mentioned his descending. Obviously, descent off the Poggio, that's a bit of a question mark. There are other question marks as well, positioning, so on and so forth. But who knows? Who knows? That could be the first sort of big splash that he makes at Red Bull.
I'm going to drop a little hint of speculation and run away from it here. Could he be an unlikely ally for Tadej Pogacar a little further out if they want to really take on the fast riders and change the race, and, you know, at least one of them could win it then? We'll see. Anyway, we'll see. He was hugely impressive though, wasn't he? And we're speaking today, what is it, Thursday? He's won 3 out of 4 days on the bike with his new team. He's favourite to make it 4 out of 5 days today because it's a time trial, 17-kilometre time trial in the Volta a la Comunitat Valenciana. So, I mean, there's been very few starts as impressive as this to lives at new teams, haven't there?
It made me think, actually, of Oscar Freire's start in 2000, when he'd been this sort of unknown winner of the World Championships. No one really had heard of him before when he won the World Championships for Vitalicio Seguros. He then signed for MAPPE the following year, and he then proceeded to win, sort of, I think it was about three of his first five races. And that was certainly a rip-roaring start. There have been a few others, but yeah, pretty remarkable.
One thing we talked about last week was the team cohesion with Remco Evenepoel and Florian Lipovits. Lipovits, of course, a young German rider who was on the podium at the Tour de France on his debut last year. What was interesting was that the pair rode together in the Trofeo Seis Salinas, the team time trial, but Lipovits didn't start any of the other races, as far as I'm aware. It was just Remco, the Remco show, wasn't it? And the other thing that leapt out was the young French rider to the pro cycling, Daniel, Mathis Rondel. Well, we had a tip-off from Larry Warbass a few weeks ago, didn't we? He was his kind of tip for a bit of a breakthrough season. And I was certainly impressed with him. He was the only person left standing with Remco, and he held on the longest, didn't he, on that race on Saturday. The final stage in Palma, Rob, Arne Marit, another win for Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, ahead of Max Kanter of XDS Astana and Alessio Magagnotti of Red Bull as well. So they've had a good opening week to their season there in Mallorca, haven't they? And yeah, Remco Evenepoel, Tadej Pogacar going away on the Cipressa, something to look forward to, something to speculate on in the next 5 weeks.
Mathis Rondel, I missed the opportunity to mention this a couple of weeks ago when we did discuss him with Larry, but his father is pretty much the Eddie Merckx / Tadej Pogacar, or was, of inline skating. He holds an extraordinary number of world records, the world record distance records mainly. 48 hours, he travelled 729 kilometres in 48 hours. That's just one of the, it looks like dozens of world records that he holds. 100 kilometre world records, 24 hours, 48 hours. I think there was one record, the equivalent of the distance around the world. He holds that, or he held that at one time.
Inline skating, as in rollerblading.
Is this rollerblading?
Not ice skating.
Rollerblading. Patinel de vitesse, what's that in English? That is.
Were you into the rollerblading craze?
Rollerblades.
Yeah, yeah. Were you guys into the rollerblading craze?
No.
Oh, that was like a big thing in the late 90s.
Late
90s. We were pretending to
late
play 90s. Hockey
about 25.
On the drive in front of us. Some of us weren't.
So that chaps was the Challenge Mallorca, pretty much the Remco show. Challenge Mallorca, of course, isn't a proper stage race. We discussed that last week. One stage race that did happen last week was the Alula Tour in Saudi Arabia. And that was won by Jan Christen after a pretty spectacular attack on the final day. He'd had a very eventful week. Again, as discussed last week, I described him as the Marc Soler of Juan Ayuso's. That was sort of a reference to some of his histrionics on the road in the first two or three stages last week, including a 20-second penalty for holding onto a car. There was a bit of an altercation with Total Energy rider. Then there was a badly mistimed attack on one of the hilly days, which cost him time. And it looked as though it wasn't going to happen for him. But on the final day, with an intriguing tactic that he described or explained later, it was a bit of a sort of fake attack, a kind of a fake news attack that drew his rivals out, and then he sort of hit them with the sucker punch and went away and duly took the general classification. Did the old Victor Gyökeres celebration as he came over the line. If it had been a true faithful tribute to the Arsenal striker, he probably would have fallen off his bike and ended in a ditch, because Victor Gyökeres is not having the best season. But yes, that really, the confirmation of what we thought this year was going to look like, really, for Jan Christen. We expect this to be a bit of a breakthrough year for him. Of course, he's had some very good results before. But chaps, any big takeaways from that race besides Jan Christen's final day stage win and overall victory?
Well, that overall victory was his first ever GC win. That's the first thing to mention about that. You said breakthrough year. That's already a step forward, isn't it, when you take a stage race for the first time. The other sort of thing to talk about, I guess, was the sprinting, wasn't it? Two victories for Milan back-to-back. But Matteo Malucelli managed to beat Jonathan Milan, which I guess is an interesting little thing going forward to the Giro d'Italia.
The other thing to note is that it's given UAE Team Emirates an even faster start to the season than they had last year. At this stage last year, they had five victories, including Jonathan Narváez's win in the Ecuadorian National Championships. And, well, Christian's stage win and GC gives UAE Team Emirates six wins, including Jay Vine's Aussie Time Trial Championship. I mean, how do we count these wins? I mean, last year, UAE Team Emirates had 88 race wins, but 99 if you include national titles and Pogacar's world and European titles. So no sign of UAE Team Emirates slowing down. They're actually off to a better start, admittedly very early days, than they were even last year.
Yeah, last year Christian's programme was, well, it wasn't necessarily the sort of A-tier races. It was very much about sort of accumulating experience for him last year. This year, he has, well, the team have sort of taken a, he's going to take a step up in terms of the races that he's actually going to be doing. His programme, Classico Jaén, then the Ruta del Sol, Ardèche Classic, Drôme Classic, Strade Bianche, Tirreno Adriatico. So it's a pretty full programme. Then he does the Ardennes Classics and, of course, the Giro d'Italia as well. So it's going to be interesting to see where he sort of fits in the UAE hierarchy. A lot of people already suspecting that there might be a few wrinkles there, a few sort of power struggles in that team with all the various personal ambitions. Of course, Almeida is also doing the Giro d'Italia. Chaps, another stage race has begun. And Rob, you're already commentating on the latest stage race in Spain. Tell us what that is.
That's the Volta a la Comunidad Valenciana, the Tour of Valencia, 77th edition of the race. I mean, probably the biggest meeting of big stage race minds that we've had this season already. Evenepoel is racing his first proper stage race. You mentioned Almeida, that's where he's starting his season, and already on the first day, he missed the split when it all happened on the way into the final sprint finish. That sprint finish was won for the first time in almost 600 days by Binyam. Binyam Girmay is back racing for the new NSN team. It was a super win led out by Lewis Askey. He was able to transfer over and they combined fantastically on day one. Kudos too to Arne Marit. Lionel mentioned that his teammate Magagnotti was third on the day in Palma. Marit had been told prior to that day that despite the fact that he was a sort of established sprinter, he was a new signing, he was going to have to lead out the 19-year-old Magagnotti for the development team. It worked out well for Marit, who looked good again in that first stage in Valencia, second to Binyam, which is certainly nothing to be ashamed of at all. Really, really good result, but a bad result for Mats Pedersen, I'm afraid, who's crashed out on day one and has some nasty injuries and broken bones already after half a day of racing in 2026. The stage race goes on to a time trial today. We've got a couple of mountain days, Friday and Saturday, and then the short typical stage finishing in Valencia on Sunday. That's sort of less than 100 kilometres. You look at the profile, you think sprint, but there's a big climb in the middle and it's often race full gas with some pretty interesting things happening in the last few years. We all remember Rui Costa coming in at last minute and sort of stealing the GC there. So anything can happen in what's always an interesting
what
race.
What does that mean for Mads Pedersen and his classics campaign? I mean, there's still plenty of time. It's a fractured wrist, isn't it? And a few other injuries, but the fractured wrist sounds like the most serious.
Yeah, the team still haven't said what the implications of that crash are for the rest of his programme. They've said that they will communicate on that in due course. So difficult to know. But left wrist and collarbone, that sounds as though certainly the first part of his classics programme is probably going to be in jeopardy, I would suggest.
Yeah, I mean, last year he started at the Étoile de Bessèges, which was kind of truncated, wasn't it, after the cars got onto the course. Then he rode the Tour de la Provence, which is just a little three-day stage race. It was last year. And then Paris-Nice. Well, Paris-Nice is only a month away, isn't it? So if that was intending to be that or Tirreno Adriatico as the big preparation race for the classics, that's not very far away at all. So a real blow there for Pedersen, probably. Certainly, Milan-San Remo, Gent-Wevelgem, or in Flanders Fields, as it's now known, which he won last year. And I think he was probably going to have a tilt at winning one of the very biggest ones, having been second at the Tour of Flanders last year and third at Paris-Roubaix. You know, there's only a kind of a quarter turn to go from there to, you know, having the chance to win one of those outright.
Let's be honest, Mats Pedersen's career now is about winning a monument, isn't it? That's what is left to do for him. He's been a world champion. He's won at the very biggest stage races in the world. He's won some very good classics, but he wants to win a monument. His season, yes, he's going to go back to the Tour this year, which is good for him. You know, Milan has been forced to swap roles, hasn't he, and go to the Giro this year after Pedersen missed out on the Tour last year. But I think if he were to choose, the biggest thing he could do in his career now would be to win a monument. And his chances all come in spring, don't they?
Lionel, you mentioned last year's Étoile de Bessèges, which Pedersen rode, and you mentioned the fact that that was curtailed because of various safety concerns, cars on the course, and it was pretty much a disaster. I remember we heard from Steven de Jong last year, Mads Pedersen's direct sportive Little Trek, one of the teams that left early. Now, there were a lot of concerns then that would be the last ever edition of the Étoile de Bessèges. It was such a fiasco, such a debacle. And of course, that is a sort of independently owned small French race, been owned by many years by a family called the Fongil is their name. And the good news this year was that the Étoile de Bessèges has gone ahead, is going ahead again. And we had the first stage yesterday that was won by Tom Krabber ahead of Lucas Kubisch of Unibet Rose Rockets. But just on that, the Étoile de Bessèges, good to see that it has survived. It's been scaled down somewhat. Last year, I think there were 10 World Tour teams. Some of those World Tour teams have not come back. Little Trek, for example, have not come back. But four World Tour teams are starting that race this year. And there was an interview with the now owner of the race, or the Claudine Fongil, race director, a couple of days ago, just talking about the lengths they've gone to keep that race alive, better escort, more sort of volunteers involved, and so on and so forth. So fingers crossed that race passes off smoothly this year. But just reading that interview with her, it was sort of another story that brought home just the sort of strain that we've been talking about a lot over the last few months, the strain that there is on this sport just in terms of teams, races, and the sort of scramble to try to make more money or enough money in order to just keep the wheels turning. Another thing I was going to mention, and we'll maybe go on to talk about this in more depth next week. There was a very interesting Substack post this week about the financial problems of a couple of Dutch teams in particular. Picnic Post NL was the main one. And now this was the Money in Sport Substack. And the rather alarming title of the post was Picnic Post NL's €19.5 million operating losses in the last 3 years. How is this team still racing? And there was a really good analysis of the team's balance sheet in that post. Some really striking details. For example, in 2024, the personnel costs of the team were 134.5% of the team's revenues. Of course, the main revenue for a cycling team is the amount they're paid by sponsors. In this team's case, so Picnic Post NL, the revenues were 11.7 million. And as I just said, the personnel costs alone well exceeded that. Anyway, as I said, a lot of detail in this post. We'll maybe go into it next week. But the sort of clear message from that post was that the team is in some financial difficulty. I asked them for a comment this morning, and they replied, the team, this is spokesperson replied, not sure how much value it will bring to for us to comment on this now, and we'd rather focus on the future and racing. But as I said, we'll maybe talk about that a bit more next
Presumably
week.
Presumably those figures predate the sale of Oscar Onley to Ineos Grenadiers. Let's yes. hope the transfer even... fee was 19.5 million euros.
Well, there is the suggestion... this might be speculative, but there is a suggestion in that post. And as I said, it's a pretty authoritative sounding piece that the Oscar Onley transfer was actually essential for that team to carry on. Again, we'll try to verify this and talk about it more in the future.
Obviously, as well, proves what a wonderful job they've been doing to get any sort of results with significantly less financial resources than the rest. You talk about teams disappearing, and whilst you're on the subject of the Étoile de Bessèges, just to finish that point briefly off, Tom Krabbe races for Flanders Baloise, who are scheduled to disappear at the end of the year, given the fact that the Flemish local government has pulled out of sponsorship of that. So great news that they made it the Stade van Bessèges again in instead of the Étoile de Bessèges. And maybe good news that the headlines... inevitable headlines about the fact that they've won a do, even though that they're probably going to disappear at the end of the year, might raise a few eyebrows in Flanders and might, against an increasingly difficult tide to swim against, find a sponsor for them to continue, because it is an institution, isn't it, the Flanders Baloise team.
Just on this whole question of races, security on the courses, safety and what have you, it does feel like this discussion that it feels like I've been having for 20 odd years covering cycling, the almost untenable invisible strings that hold it all together. It does feel like we're reaching a bit of a tipping point here, you know, with the difficulty of keeping these races on, the need for volunteers and sponsorship and all of the rest of that. And then, as from the team's point of view, when you've got multi-million euro assets, you know, Mads Pedersen, riders can crash in any event. They can crash in the biggest one-day races, the Grand Tours. Unfortunately, crashes are a part and parcel of the sport. But there's a sort of sense of almost futility, isn't there? You know, what's the point of sending your star assets to get match fit for the big races in the spring, and then all of those plans are completely turned upside down by a crash and broken bones, and the sense that these races are kind of just about clinging on, does cast a bit of a cloud across this time of season. It does feel to me like there's too much on, everyone's spread a bit too thinly, and maybe this part of the season is the bit that everybody should concentrate on trying to firm up a bit and make it so that there are, you know, some genuinely high level preparation races for the prestigious events to come. But, you know, that we've been saying this for 15, 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, I guess a lot of people would argue that that's what, for example, the UAE Tour is.
True.
For example.
Well, and also the Cadel Evans Great Ocean Road Race, which in comparison with the Tour Down Under, you know, is high profile, it's well organised, it's, you know, it's prestigious, it gets big crowds and what have you. And a big win there for Tobias Lund Andersen as well, who won that opening stage of the Tour Down Under, didn't he? And that was ahead of Matt Brennan. So any win ahead of Matt Brennan is, is pretty good going at this stage. Andersen, of course, rides for Decathlon. Grand Prix Marseillaise as well was on the weekend. A shame from my point of view, having been there a few years ago, that they had changed the finale. They cut the Route de Crête, which is it's a kind of spectacular, picturesque, a nice climb as well. But when I think back to when we were on that climb, Francois, Simon Gill and myself, the roads were open literally 2-3 minutes before the race came through, and there was a real kind of, you know, holding of breath. I mean, for the spectators who were up there, probably didn't think anything of it, but I could see the riders coming up just down the road, and cars were still on the course. So they wanted to make the finale a bit less climbery, so it was more suited to sprinters, and well, they got that kind of result because Brian Cockart won the race.
Although Lecoq is saying, has been saying in the French press, that he no longer considers himself, as of this year, he's not going to consider himself a sprinter. He's been working a lot on his sort of short, sharp climbs. So we may see more of that from him this year. But good result for Cofidis, of course, we covered at the end of last year. Just what a sort of shambles they had become at the end of last year. Of course, they've had a change at the top with Raphaël Jeune coming in for Cédric Vassel. But good start for those boys.
And it was still a lumpy finish. I mean, it wasn't a sprint finish, was it? So, yeah, Brian Coquart going to be rivaling Pogacar at the Tour de France. Maybe we'll revive our Coquart t-shirts, Daniel, from probably a decade ago now.
I don't remember
that. You had one, I think. You had a Coquart t-shirt, yeah.
What did it say Coquart on it? Just... Oh, God. What wags we were back then.
When we still all had senses of humour.
Yeah, we hadn't had it beaten out of us. Chaps, that, I think, just about completes the roundup of the week's racing. Rob, you've got to go for a haircut in a minute. Just before you do, I'm going to mention one other thing. Last year, we talked about Jonas Vingegaard's crash in training, and there'd been a bit of sort of hand-wringing about whether this had been caused by an amateur rider who had kind of tagged along or been maybe a little bit starstruck and wanted to ride along with Vingegaard. We were contacted by a listener, Victor Perez Abela, because we had speculated about why Vingegaard was training in Malaga. Victor sent me a message saying that regarding Vingegaard, he owns a house in the nicest neighbourhood of Malaga. Well, he has owned a house since 2022, more or less. People often see him during winter training on his own over there. And we also talked about Victor Campanaerts last week in Andalusia. Victor says Campanaerts bought a house as well in 2023 near Canillas de Aceituno. But since he's had a kid, he's not been there very much. Vingegaard was pictured again in the last couple of days, still training down there in Malaga. And incidentally, the young gentleman who posted the initial report of Vingegaard's crash on Strava, so the young rider, he was a young amateur rider who had been sort of implicated in that whole incident. He's been doing the rounds, or he's certainly been on one Spanish podcast, Rob, that I listened to the other day. I think it's called BC Lab. Didn't bring a whole lot of additional insight to what we already knew about that crash. He sort of talked about how Vingegaard, seemed a little bit irritated, seemed a little bit annoyed that he was trying to follow Vingegaard down the climb or down the descent, and he went into a corner too fast, and then we know what happened. Anyway, chaps, that concludes that pretty sorry business, which we already dealt with last week. We'll be back next week, I suppose. Again, lots of racing. What?
You suppose? Maybe. We'll be back.
Usually, yeah.
Muscat Classic, Tour of Oman, and then, well, we probably won't quite catch the first day of the Tour de la Provence, because I think that starts on Friday next week.
Cyclocross over now?
Well, more or less. I mean, there's still a few little events going on, but the world's, that's the pinnacle of the season, isn't it? The much anticipated. Rob, you're off to commentate on the Winter Olympics. What events are you commentating on?
The short track speed skating, which I covered all the way back in Korea. I was very lucky to be in Korea for that, and what a spectacle it was.
I mean, it's basically like track cycling, isn't it? Same tactics. Very similar.
Very similar.
I'll be watching that avidly. Daniel's head in his hands here. Yeah. I've got the curling on already.
I'm surprised that one of you didn't try and... isn't the European Track Championships going on? I'm surprised one of you didn't try and shoehorn that in this week. Anyway.
Do you know what? I'm going to give a mention to Matthew Richardson, because he beat Harry Lavresen to take the European title. First time in what, about 5 or 6 years that Lavresen's been beaten in a big medal final. So that for the... now British rider from Perth in Australia. That is a brilliant, brilliant result.
Another win in the Ashes on bikes, Rob. Thanks, everyone. Thanks.
Okay, chaps. See you again. Thank you very much,
Rob. See you in real life next week, Rob. We're going to have lunch, aren't we?
Yeah, I will do. Look forward to it.
See you, Daniel. Possibly in real life.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
Game day starts before kickoff. Get ready for the big game with help from Menards. Find great deals on sofas and recliners to keep guests comfortable all game long. Score big savings and stock up on game day goodies. Shop a variety of snacks and drinks to keep your party fueled up. Make Menards a part of your game plan. Shop in store or on Menards.com and save big money. Save.